Okay, so welcome everybody. First of all, Rav Mendelovich has a sefer that he wrote. It's in the back after the shiur. If you'd like him to autograph it or write something in there, makes a great Hanukkah gift, and also just a very good book. In Beis Tefila, we're talking about something that would be good for with regards to Hanukkah. I know myself when I was growing up, so I always used to march in the Soviet Jewry marches in Manhattan, and it was a very big thing in our family. I used to actually carry the sign Free Sharansky now, but we had pen pals also. I had a pen pal for my bum. I think it might have been my father had that one. Yeah. Sorry. And my bar mitzvah also, it was very in our shul. There was no email, so we had actually pen pals. We actually wrote a letter to someone who was going to be our twin for our bar mitzvah, who was not allowed to have a bar mitzvah in Russia. And I just know that, talking to people around the neighborhood or some, kids, whatever, I say, I used to march in the what? The Soviet Jew. A lot of kids have no clue. And actually, some parents also don't have any clue what it was and what it meant to grow up in Russia at that time, and also just the mesiras nefesh that so many wonderful yidden had in Russia, and like Hanukkah, there was gzeros, and I'm sure Rav Mendelovich will go through them, and really we're very fortunate to have Rav Mendelovich here to not only to read about it in a book or to hear about it from someone second hand or third hand, it's actually first hand, it's history. And we should all just enjoy it, and also take the message home that that the Jewish neshama is very strong, and we have a living proof here of someone, and we're very, very fortunate to have Rav Mendelovich here in Beis Tefila.
Okay, I have to apologize. My English is not that good, but I will try to do my best. Yeah, sure. So I will tell you a couple of stories how it was about. There are some events in my life that are connected to Hanukkah. I'll tell you the first experience in Hanukkah. I was born after the Second World War in Soviet Russia. Actually, in Latvia, which was at the time a part of Soviet Union, nowadays it is still, it is again an independent republic. Me and all my peers of my age were assimilated almost. We got no Jewish education at all. And as you know, any kind of Jewish education was illegal. We were not considered to be Jews at all. The proclaimed aim of the authorities was that we had to intermarry and forget being Jewish. My first Hanukkah, I remember, was when I was 10 years old, and I and two my sisters went to a holiday party. But it was not a Hanukkah party at all. It was a communist New Year, where it sometimes comes together. So we would dance with a communist Santa Claus around the tree, and we get all kind of, sweets, whatever. We enjoyed it very well. And we were not aware at all that there is a Jewish holiday. When we come back home, there was something stranger in our home. We saw a lot of policemen inside, searching. And we saw my father was arrested. My mother cried. And then the father was taken away. For that time, it was after Stalin, but the new communist leader, Khrushchev, staged a trials against Jews, condemning them in having illegal economical activity that would undermine the state of Soviet Union. For you know, that time they were still very poor, and then Russian people were idle, a lot of them drunkards. They simply wouldn't produce. So instead, you know, to demand to be more effective, they looked for somebody to blame on all their problems. And certainly there were Jews, the scapegoats, to be accused in all economical hardship, and then they arrested people and tried them. So it is how my father became a prisoner. And I remember when after several months of trying to put together this case, they finally staged a trial, and we come with my father and my two sisters come to be on the trial. They were not permitted to enter the court, so we are outside the building. Imagine the big building of the Soviet court, and from another across the street, Jewish family, father, my mother, and three children, afraid, scared, what will happen? And I remember myself that time that I all of a sudden felt that I can help my father. So how can I help a child? Then I remember start telling something like that. I ask you, help my father. I promise you I'll be a good boy. I will do whatever I have to do just to help my father out from the jail. And then I asked myself, what am I telling? To whom I am talking? I had no answer. Obviously, it was my first prayer, first tefillah. And, you know, I experienced a tefillah without knowing it. Like, you know, my Jewish soul would pray by itself. So how it started, you know. Almost unconsciously, I became involved in this our constant Jewish way. And then, later on, my father was sentenced to 5 years of imprisonment for being accused in involved in illegal economical activity, which was false, was not true. And my mother got ill, and later on she died, passed away from all that happened. When my father came back, he was a broken man. He didn't serve all the 5 years. He was released, but finally they found him innocent. But it took all his life, you know, broken home, no wife, no parnosa. So he started telling us something like that. Sure, he told, here people hate us, but there is another place in the world where the sky is blue all over the year and the sun is shining, and what is more important, people don't hate us. For all of them are Jewish. They couldn't believe in it. But you know, sometimes when the reality is bleak, you try to escape to a dream. So it was our dream that we would make ourselves going to Israel, put together chairs, and each of us as a child taking a plaything or a book or something, and we are going to Israel. So it is for the beginning, it was a part of our childhood, and lately it became a part of our life. Now at age 16, I decided that I have to go to work in an enterprise to bring parnosa to my father, to help him economically. I would work during the day, and at evening I would go to study in high school. For still the big dream of a Jewish father, that as he would say, sure, I my life is broken, but at least you will become a doctor or a lawyer, whatever. So I studied there in the high school, and what turned out very specific about this high school, that for the first time I met there Jewish boys, you know. Normally in the capital of Latvia, Riga, is like some 800,000 residents, and there was a very small community of Jews, like some 30,000. But as Miguel Esther says, "Am mefuzarum meforad," this first, we never met, for there was no real community, there was no Rov, no, there was one single synagogue that wouldn't be destructed during the Second World War just because it was between two churches. It is why the Jews wouldn't burn it down. So I never met, my whole Am Yisrael was my family. And then all of a sudden I met other boys, and when we talked, I discovered that in childhood they would play the same game as me, going to Israel. So, and then, step by step, I discovered a different dimension in my life. For one day, a friend of my Jewish boy would say, "Today we are not studying, today is a new year." I thought, how strange, you know. Do we have in September a new year? September should be in January. He told me, "No, it's the Jewish New Year." You know, okay, yes, no, it's strange with the Jewish people. Just imagine, you know, how far I was that time. So what to do? All of us are going to this synagogue. Me, you know, an educated man, I'm dreaming to be maybe a scientist, whatever. How can I go to a synagogue? It's a religious place. Anyway, friends would go up to the synagogue. So, you know, I felt bad to stay alone. So I escorted them, I followed them. And then when we come to the synagogue, sure, we wouldn't enter the synagogue. We just stayed outside in the street, in a yard. And we met other friends. So it was very joyful, you know, meeting friends. There was a crowd of youngsters, boys and girls, you know. We enjoyed, for the first time, mixing with Jews, not with the goyim. So I enjoyed it, and I asked the friends when the Jews would have another holiday to come again, you know. So they told in the next 10 days, you know, it's Yom Kippur. You know, for me it wouldn't make any difference, you know, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, there is a reason to come and to meet people, so that's fine. And I would say it's like, you know, see, Hashgoche. My Jewish life started in Hanukkah when I was 10 years ago. As a consequence, I finally had to work an enterprise to go to study in high school. I met friends, and I come to the synagogue. It's really Hashgoche, you know, like somebody is moving me to this right direction without me taking any decision, you know. The only decision that I made, to go to work in an enterprise. I never would decide that I would become religious or become close to Am Yisrael. It's a Yad Hashgacha, as we say. And later on, in the same school, another friend of mine, Leib Levinson, would say that, you know, he told us, next Sunday, the Jewish youth of Riga will come together to rebuild the Jewish cemetery. So you are invited to come. You know how strange it may sound here in Israel and in any other place. It was altogether bizarre in Soviet Russia. How we Jews will come to reconstruct a Jewish cemetery, you know. On Sunday, it was the only free day, you know. As a friend of mine would say, "No, I'm going with my girlfriend to see a movie. You know, what I have to spend it to go to the cemetery? I'm crazy." And somebody else would say, "We have tests." And I, for some reason, I felt that I have to go to this place. A Jewish place, a Jewish cemetery. And the Jews are coming together, you know. It was my decision. Again, you know, I wouldn't figure out what will happen in the consequence. I felt simply that something is very important to me. So I went to this cemetery. Also, my mother was in buried in a different one, and I was never aware that in Riga they have two cemeteries. It's a small place. Anyway, they told me the number of the bus, so I went there, and when I started from the bus and I looked around, indeed there was no cemetery around. And then I recollected my father telling me, never go there, you know, I have my bad experience. Certainly the police announced it to scratch the Jews that would be interested to come, and they would put you in a blacklist, and you would never be admitted to study in university. So my father told me, you know, I have a big experience meeting with Russian police, never go there. But how you can prevent a Jewish youngster, as I say to my sons, never go, it's dangerous, and don't care. I will take care, you know, father, everything will be okay. So it's how I told to my father. And when I come there and I understood that nothing happens, you know. Certainly there is a certain KGB man sitting in a bushes and already photographing and listening me in this black list. So I was that disappointed that I went back to this bus station to go home. And for a last moment I look around, there was a forest there and a big field and a Latvian countryside. And all of a sudden I saw some people inside the forest. I looked closely and I felt that they are Jewish. So I start running through the field, through the forest, and something like Ruach HaKodesh would say to me, Yosef, now it is a new page in your life. I was so excited, indeed, to meet there in the forest some group of older Jews. They were not young Jews, some 20 or maybe 30 Jews doing something very strange that I couldn't understand, but I was glad at least to meet them. You know, my name is Yosef, as they say, Yosef is meeting his brother. That time it was a negative meaning. This time, really, I met my brothers, you know, Jewish ones. You look at the Jewish eyes, Jewish nose, Jewish lips, like me, you know. I was glad. But then the question would be, where is the cemetery? Still, I couldn't see any cemetery. They were involved in kind of a strange activity, having big piles of sand there in the forest, and grabbing almost with the hands, taking this sand, putting in boxes, removing in a different place, spilling it down, and then coming back, collecting the sand, and this way going on and going on. I was ashamed to ask, for they really, as I understood, did know what they are doing. But then step by step, I understood what it's about. I saw big trenches in the field with some bones inside and pieces of clothes. So I understood that it is a place of a massacre during the Holocaust. And people told me that here on the place, some 30,000 local Jews were killed during several days. So it was a really big, big cemetery, the field and the forest and all around. And they told me, you know, it was Kislev. It was in the eve of Hanukkah. So it is my second Hanukkah experience. And then another people would come later, like me. They heard that there was a rumor about this activity. They would come closer, look at it, and some of them, experienced ones, would ask, say, you have a permission from the authorities to do what you are doing? And the people that organized this event would say, what kind of permission you need from the authorities? If there are our families, you know, our father killed here. Do we need any permission? No, the people would answer, you know, don't you understand that it is illegal? You can't do it without permission of the authorities. and they would go back to the bus station. So the people that never asked this question, you know, there is a mitzvah. Met mitzvah, as we say. If you see a dead Jew, you have to take care of him without any calculation. It's a mitzvah. But people thought, you know, they have jobs, they have children, they have to be realistic, you know. And it's always, you know, the issue. Some very realistic people never do anything. Perhaps they have their calculation. So we are less a realistic stay there and take care of the dead people. Next Sunday, I told the friend in the school that it is in real, it is not a joke, and some more people come to join me. And it went on, so I managed after the high school to enter the university. You know, sometimes people are too much afraid. Nobody put us in a blacklist, nobody prevent us from studying. And then I remember like 3 years later, we managed to build somehow the quorum. And a lot of youngsters would come together, some hundreds of them, you know. So the dead people brought us together, you know. We never met, and we met there on the quorum. And then I remember during a break in our work, young people sitting there at the quarrying and singing. So I asked myself whether it's permitted, you know, to sing. It is a goyish way. We are not supposed to sing in Beit Kvarot. And then I answered to myself. It was not simply songs. It was a song, Am Yisrael Chai, David Melech Yisrael Chai Lekayam. So I told to myself, certainly the dead people are listening and they enjoy us singing it. And then I asked, you know, in Masechet Sanhedrin, there's a classic question, Amitim Chayim, do the dead people, are the dead people alive? And I answered to myself, yes, certainly. They are listening, they enjoy it, you know. It's again, I discovered something that other people would, you know, try to persuade themselves. I discovered I believe that the people that it's Tzadokim, Tzadikim are alive and they are listening. And I told when they were shot some 30 years ago, they would never believe that Am Yisrael still is alive. And then now they are hearing our young voices singing Am Yisrael Chai. It makes them feel good. So we continue to sing. And then we had a decision, older people decided to have like a memory meeting to memorize the people, to understand that the authorities were out to make us forget that we are Jewish. So the very fact that we were involved in building this site and this cemetery was against the will of the authorities. They would like us to forget, and we would like to remember. So it is how I became an antagonist of the Soviet power. You know, simply so, you know. You take this sound, this ground, and put in the cavern, you are again the power. For people come and will say, Kaddish, Elul Rachamim, they remember. And then, in my turn, I was permitted to speak to the crowd. We had some, I believe, thousands of Jews coming there in the forest. It was illegal altogether. But it was to remember, to say Kaddish. And I talked to my young friends and I told, see what a miracle happened to us. When we arrived here, we come to help the dead people. We would collect the bones and pieces of clothes. But now, I thought, we understand that the dead people helped us. For they gave us the meaning of being Jewish. They helped us to come together. It is like, you know, all the life of the dead people was transformed in our bodies. And I thought that I feel myself like I creep out from the grave. And it was still, I never read the time Chazon Yechezkel of the dry bones, but it is me, you know. I became alive thanks to the people. I come out from the grave and I'm looking for another future. So I told friends, let's listen what the dead people are telling us. They say us, Lech Lecha, leave this cursed place, never stay anymore. And it is how later I met some friends, all the friends that I met here in on this site several years ago, and we decided to establish a Jewish underground movement. It was 1966. To struggle assimilation, to serve for our Jewish nation, to remember that we are Jewish. And as usually, you know, normally people say clandestine is weapon, explosive materials. Our explosive materials was to get us foreign, for we were ignorant altogether. Nobody taught us. It was prohibited. So it was another effort at least to get some books, for they were not in the shops. It was not sold. Now, maybe some private libraries you can find a book, and then it was written in Russian characters that we wouldn't understand. So somehow, you know, we managed to know more than a regular Soviet Jew, and we start teaching other people in the underground Hebrew, Jewish history. And when I studied myself Hebrew, Russian Kurdish, I started giving classes in Parashat Shavua. So it how it started. And then, you know, I felt that it is not enough, for we were aware that the assimilation is growing up. That time there was some 70% of Jewish youth getting intermarried. So I felt that we have to do something else. And I thought that the only possible way is to get people out from Soviet Russia. You know, even having these small underground groups in teaching Hebrew and even Parashat Shavua is not enough to fight the massive assimilation. And then I went to the internal ministry, the Ministry of Internal Affairs, that would supposed to grant permission to leave. I was aware that they never would permit me to leave. For that time, it was altogether forbidden. But at least I felt that I have to declare that I would go to Israel. And then the procedure was that you have to have a formal invitation from your relative from Israel, that you can declare that your family was massacred during the Holocaust, and the only remnants of your family are in Israel. So you ask the human Soviet power to permit you, you know, unite your family, whatever. So finally, it was very difficult to get an invitation like that, for they would confiscate all the letters. Anyway, finally I got the invitation, and I come to see the officer in charge of giving permissions, and I told him, why you wouldn't give us permission? My father is ill, you know, and we have no family here in Israel, and my father hasn't in Soviet Russia, and my father hasn't family in Israel, so be so human to permit us to unite our family. So the officer laughed at me, and he told, what he told me, you know, you imagine that I will send you to Israel. You are an educated man. You study electronics and communication in university. You are valuable for our state. So how I would send you to Israel? That, you know, stay here, and he told me, and build our country here, our Soviet Russian country here in Soviet Union. Never you will go to Israel. And now he told me, go away. Don't disturb me in my business. So when I was out from the office, I remembered something that I taught during Pesach. You know, what kind of our activities in the underground was having a Seder Pesach in certain families, the people that would ready still invite us to show how to make a Seder Pesach, bringing some matzahs and a Gadah of Pesach. So I remember it, I recollect it, that's exactly what when Moshe and Aaron come to see the Pharaoh of Mitzrayim and ask for permission to leave, the Pharaoh would say, why are you thinking about Israel? Certainly you have a spare time. Better go, to produce more bricks, and then you will have no time to think about your, of all the nourishkeiten. So in exactly I told it what this small power told me, Go build our country, forget about Israel. And I did know that it's written, Biat Chazaka Sien Hashem Mitzrayim. It doesn't depend on the will of the Pharaoh. There's something else that decides on it. So we hoped that the miracle will happen, and the strong arm of HaKadosh Baruch Hu will take us from this Russian paradise. Anyway, I thought to myself, if so, if me studying in university make me valuable for the Soviet Union, I will stop my studies. I prefer be a simple worker, but still have any chance, to go to Israel instead to be an educated man and stay for life. So I stopped my studies. And the moment I stopped my studies in university, I was summoned to be drafted to a Red Army. So I told me how stupid I was, didn't I figure out that it will be the consequence of me finishing the studies. So what to do? And I remember the night before I had to go to this drafting station, I couldn't sleep. I go around and I felt that I have sacrificed something, like to bring a korban. For I understood that if you need something precious, you have to sacrifice something for that. So what can I sacrifice? And then I start thinking, I told Yosef, you are teaching other people being Jewish, going to Israel, back to the roots. But what does it mean? It means to become an observant Jew. It's obvious to you. Why you yourself don't behave this way? Why you don't observe mitzvahs? Also I was, I have a very dim concept. What does it mean? But I still did know that there is difference between not making any decision and just going around and talking and making a decision. So I answered, maybe the reason why I'm not becoming an observant Jew is that it is not comfortable, that I will take over a burden of obligation or whatever. I thought, it's not comfortable. So it is a kind of sacrifice, you can sacrifice. And I stood and I told Ribbono Shel Olam, I promise you, if you will take me away from the Soviet army, I will start keeping mitzvahs. So, Yaakov Avinu. And then when I went to this next day to this station, they would draft people, a certain officer interviewed me. He opened my folio, and he saw that I studied in university. Oh, I was only in the end of the studies, and all of a sudden I dropped the studies. So he asked me, what happened? What the reason you stopped your studies? If I would admit that the reason was that I would like to go to Israel, they will send me, as we say in Yiddish, in Al Dreben, Ekvelt, you are Zionist, you are going to Israel. So serve there in remote areas that sometimes people would never come back from there. So I had to look for another excuse. And then I looked around and I saw in the window a small bird sitting on the tree. And I told, see officer, the bird, it is free, It's now here, and now he can go to whatever place he would like. Not me, I told. See, I was born here, and I finished the high school. Now I entered the university. Like, everything is already decided. I finished my studies. I start working as a Russian engineer. Where is my freedom of choice? He told me, so what, you would like to be like this bird? Yeah, I told, sure. Oh, there's something strange in you, what? We don't need soldiers that would like to be like a bird. So they sent me in a mental institution for tests. I felt bitter about that, to be among crazy people. it's not joy at all, you know. So I tried to keep aside, you know. There were, you know, crazy people normally are very joyful people, you know. They make all kind of narishkeit and I was sitting in a corner. I got a big book to take my time. So I imagine when the doctor would enter our place and look at these joyful, crazy people and me, and I imagine that I'm really crazy, you know, sitting this way afraid of these crazy people. And then when they would ask me, don't you feel sometimes that somebody is watching you, you know? I thought, sure, no, I was in the underground, so it was, you know, all the feelings that we maybe followed. Anyway, in a couple of weeks, like a month, they had a medical commission, and they told me, see, you're okay, you know, you will get some medicines, and you will be normal, but now we cannot draft you in the army. So, the moment that I was out from the mental institution, imagine where I would go, directly to the synagogue. For the Rabboni Shel Olam made his part. Now I had to pay for that. So I entered this synagogue that I was already familiar from my previous experiences. There were old people. I thought, can you teach me being Yiddish, you know, being observing Jews? Old people got afraid, you know. Imagine in these years, a young man all of a sudden would like to become an observing Jew. Or he is a crazy man, or he is a provocator. So he said, no, we cannot teach you, this is illegal, we are not permitted to teach you. There was another man, a younger one, Rabbi Mordechai Binur, Zecher Tzedekim Livrachazit, took me and told me several things, and opened a siddur, and explained how to pray, whatever. Not too much, but it was a beginning. So, you know, when my friends in the underground they found out that I became religious, that would ask me, see, you really fast and at Yom Kippur? Yeah, sure. And you don't eat Hametz and Pesach, only matzahs here. They say, it's too much. We understand your sympathy to Jewish heritage, but it is fanatic, you know. You are a modern man. How can you be doing like that? But I, you know, I did know that it is not enough. Simply, you know, had no framework really to become an observing Jew. It was mostly my desire. And then, in the flow of the activities, our group in Riga managed to establish contacts with similar groups in different places, like in Moscow, Leningrad, Odessa, Kiev, and we established in 1969 a nationwide underground Jewish organization. And I became an editor of a Jewish underground newsletter. So we would write about the Jewish tradition and our struggle for going out from Soviet Russia, whatever. And thanks of these connections, once a man come up from Leningrad, nowadays it is St. Petersburg, to see me, and he told me, yourself, you would like to escape from Soviet Russia? I thought, certainly. But he told me, you understand what I mean? Illegally. I'm all for that. But he told me, think again, you know. It may be dangerous, you know. We may be arrested, or maybe even killed on the border. I thought, see, there is no life for me as a Jew in Soviet Russia. So if you say that there is even 1% out of 100 to escape, I'm all for that. It is my 100%. Okay, he told me. Now I'll tell you a story. We got in Leningrad a new student in our underground Ulpan that turned to be a former Russian airman in Air Forces, Mr. Dimshit. So he suggested that if we would be able to take over to buy tickets on a regular Soviet aircraft going around inside Soviet Russia and take over, he would lead us over the border and we shall become free. So I thought that, you know, it sounds very beautiful. It's a good idea to do that. He would say, think again, you know, understand how dangerous it is. I thought, what the danger, you know? I'm glad to do that. And then I met other people trying to mobilize more passengers on this airplane. Certainly, I would approach people that I didn't know. And all of them were so excited, you know. Like I remember a friend of mine, Arya Hanoch, that now is living in Balkan settlement, and I told him the same, you know, Arya, would you like to try to escape illegally, you know, to fly away from Soviet Russia? He was so excited. He embraced me and kissed me and told me, you know, how I'm thankful you that you invited me to do this, like I'm inviting you to having a party. I told him, Arya, think, you know, it is maybe dangerous. Think again. He told, you don't understand. If I would find out later that you did it and you wouldn't invite me, I would hate me for all my life. Now I feel myself privileged. You know, certainly not all Jews would do that, but it was a kind of, you know, of a group so idealistic that we never would make all the calculations, figure out in small details. It was a big dream, and we felt glad to be inside the dream, to become free Jews, to go to Eretz Israel. And then this Mr. Dreamschitz called us up and told that he saw in a newspaper an announcement telling that they opened a new route, a new flight that will bring us close to the border, to the Finnish border, like 50 kilometers. And then he took the trip already and checked it, and he found it that it's very, very easy to use it for this specific airplane, a small one, only for 12 passengers, would stop in a forest, and it was not manned by personnel. So he told, instead of fighting people, the pilots in the air, we would better to make them land, and then all passengers on the board, being us, for we bought all the tickets, would simply invite them, you know, instead of us going out from the plane, just invite them to leave the plane and stay in the forest, and then Mr. Dimshus would take the guide and fly us over the Finnish border, Baltic Sea, and land in Sweden, for we were aware that the Finnish government has an agreement to give away all people that would try to escape from Soviet Russia. So it would take only some 20-30 minutes, you know, a very short flight. We were so glad. So we went to the place, to this airport. It was close to Leningrad, the place, a local small airport that we had to take this airplane. And we were in the forest at night before we were out to go to the airport. And all of a sudden, we saw two black cars coming close to our place. So we understood that it is the KGB, these secret services. And some plainclothes people would start out from the black cars. You know, we could find out that it is their cars, for they had a special number, 00050006. So these plainclothes people would walk around in the forest, like looking for us. Then they come back, but, you know, we sat together to decide what to do. It's obvious that we are being watched and followed. But nobody of us would say, let us escape. For I thought, see friends, our victory is the very fact that we left our apartment and that we started go to the right direction. Not necessarily we can reach the direction, but what is important to continue. If we come back, it is our failure. And everybody was agreed to do that. So we wait for the next morning. In the morning, we come to the airport, and it was announced, boarding, flight number that and that. So we start going to the direction, and all of a sudden, I saw that Mr. Dimshit is missing. What happened, you know? Maybe he was already arrested. I decided to go around, to start running back to look for Mr. Dimshit, and I saw him being far away with his family. He took his wife and two daughters, and they sat for breakfast. So I got so angry, I told Mark, we are already on the way to Eretz Israel, and you are eating your sandwiches. He checked his watch and he told me there is a problem. The boarding has to be started at 9 o'clock and now it is only 8:30. Something wrong in that, he told. I don't like that. I thought, okay, Mark, you know, you are accustomed to Russian army. Everything there is smooth and accurate, but it's, you know, a different place. So he told, okay, I'll take my belongings, run back to tell the friends that I am joining, whatever. So, you know, as glad and excited as I was before, for I'm going to bring freedom to my nation, I'm Israel Chai. And then I found the pilot, you know, I almost... myself was already in the air from my pride and excitement. So when I come back, all of a sudden I was pushed on the baton and they already put ropes on my hands. They wouldn't have even bracelets. And when I stood up, although my glasses fell down, I could see that the time I would run back to look for Mr. Dinshitz, all other friends were already arrested. There was a lot of military troops, paratroopers, and a lot of dogs, something terrible. And then when I saw it, I heard shootings. I turned around and I saw Mr. Dinshitz being escorted and bleeding. All his face was with blood. And his wife crying, and the small daughters crying. It was really a tragedy, you know. Imagine, only like a couple of minutes before, we were already in the heaven, and all of a sudden we fell down. So it turned out that they would indeed follow us, indeed about our preparation. And I was brought to the first questioning on the spot in this airport. There was two major generals on special tasks would question me, and they brought me, produced a paper, the order to arrest me, saying, according to our knowledge, in this specific airport, a group of Jewish terrorists is having the task to harm state security and to escape to imperialistic country of Israel, and prosecutor general would say, I order to arrest them, to inquire them, and if it would be find true, tell them that they will get death penalty. So, you know, I felt very bad about that, this bottom line of telling about this death penalty. Okay, I told, how I can sign, you know, you robbed my hands, I cannot move my hands. So, lose these ropes. And I made myself like reading again, and I thought, no, I will never sign it. Ah, you are a scoundrel, you laugh at us, you know, you think you are strong, you are courageous, we shall show you our courage. You know, we'll take you interrogation to our special KGB prison, you will tell everything. So it is how I started this part of me being a prison, and it was a bad time, indeed, you can imagine. For mostly people arrested, you know, the very idea of being in the prison of KGB, open your mouth, you know. And they would start working on a specific person that in their understanding had something to lose, and then break him, and then come to another one and say, see, your friend is cleverer than you, he is already cooperating, he is giving away names, what about you? And the second one would say, okay, you know, this one, I know he was a strong man, but now if he cooperates, let me do the same. So they break everybody. And they did know everything. Arrested all people that were somehow involved or did know it was something terrible. So finally, you know, their task was to break us and to stage a big performance of a trial that we would ask, you know, for... to pardon us, and we would admit that it was a mistake and blame all the Jewish nation and call up a Soviet jury, stop being involved on all kind of Jewish activities and got assimilated, you know, to use us, Jewish fellows, to work against Am Yisrael. And they felt that it's very close at hand. It was very, very terrible. So, they told me, why you are not cooperating? Why are you not giving away their names? You are not afraid of us? I told, no, I'm not afraid of you. So, you know, it's an abnormal way of conduct, you know. Everybody's here is afraid, not you. So they sent me again to a mental institution. And when I come to this mental institution, it turned to be another KGB prison. There were KGB officers with white coat. And I'm sorry. They told me if you wouldn't admit you are being guilty and you wouldn't give away the names, we'll simply treat you with medicals and injections and you'll get crazy yourself. For it was the kind of treatment that would treat their people that were against their power. And in this specific prison were already people that were treated this way. It's really, you know, a stick of flesh now. And not human anymore. So take it away. Now, I was afraid, but you know, what I could do about that? I couldn't give away my friend. It was impossible. But a miracle happened. I will not give all the details. Finally, I was sent back to the prison. And they changed their tactics. I was met with another interrogator, a different one, a very quiet, polite man, and that would say to me, Yosef, you know, you are a young man. Don't you understand that you are risking your life, you know? You'll certainly get death penalty. Why are you that stubborn, you know? You have to be realistic. You have to understand that you can't break the wall with your head, you know? Just admit that it was a mistake, you know. Ask for pardon. You'll get some 7-8 years of imprisonment. And out you will be still a young man. You can start your life again. And then he would say, I look at you. You don't look Jewish at all, you know. Why you say you are Jewish? You got Russian education. You know a lot of Russian poetry like Pushkin and Lermontov and Dostoevsky. What's Jewish about you? So, and he thought, you know, I understand that you have values, but it's not the place, you know, to have values. Just be realistic. So, when I was back to my cell, you know, I was thinking, going around, you know, maybe he's right, you know. It's not the place to be stubborn, you know. They will simply kill me for that. And then I got angry with myself. I thought, what he promised me life? What kind of life? When I admit that it is wrong to be Jewish, it's not a life at all. The meaning of my life, the joy of my life being Jewish. So if I will take this joy of being Jewish, my life wouldn't have any sense. It would be like a life of a dog. And then they told me, what he is telling that I am not Jewish, that I don't look like Jewish. I felt that I have to build a wall between me and him to make him understand that I am different altogether. So I felt so bad that I didn't manage to study too much when I was with Mr. Dino and the older people. But still I have to produce something. What can I do to behave myself Jewish, to make him understand that I am altogether different? I dreamt to have payas and a beard and a kippah, just, you know, look like a regular Jew. Then he would never tell me that I am not Jewish. But now I was like him. I spoke his language. I had his mentality. So somehow he has right to tell that. Okay, I thought, kippah, what's my kippah? I had no kippah. I had some kippah, but it was confiscated during the arrest. So I have to look for a kippah. And now I came, I decided to take my handkerchief. I had a handkerchief, it was permitted, to make knots on the handkerchief, like, you know, you have it on summer, on the head, like this, from four angles, put on my head, like this. And when escorted next time to this office of the interrogator, he told me, what, you are really crazy, you know, what, you put this piece of cloth on your head, remove it immediately, don't pretend be crazy, you know, I know you are an educated man, you know how to behave, so I demand behave. I thought, okay, you know, I behave. It's our Jewish culture, you know. You go in, remove your hat when you enter the room, and we Jews are the other way. The other way, you cover our hat. And then I produced him a whole lecture about Jewish history and Jewish tradition. So it was the first protocol that I would sign. It was wrong as well, never signed any protocol. But anyway, so he told me, you think that you are smart, I tell you you are stupid. For I see from here already you are preparing your grave for yourself. For you will certainly, for your cheeky behavior, get the harshest penalty. Take him away. So when I was in my cell again, I felt better, you know. When my enemy is angry, it means that I am on the right way. So I thought, what else can I do as a Jew in a cell without anything, you know? Again, I have nobody to consult. So I decided a simple way. I will start praying, you know. I had kind of experience of praying in a synagogue, but I had no siddur. I decided that I will write like a tefillah by myself, something like Shmoneh Esrei. For I was myself a teacher in Hebrew, so I did know some 500 words and experiences, expressions, and then I did daven sometimes in a shul. So I wrote a prayer, and then I told myself, where should be Mizrach, you know? It was a cell in a basement room, and there was, you couldn't, nobody to ask where is the Mizrach, where is the Meir, you know? They would suspect you tried to escape maybe from the cell. So I decided, one moment, now in a Sefer of Daniel is written that when Daniel was in Babel, he would come up as say Aliyat Agag on the second floor, would open the window and pray in the direction of Yerushalayim, direct his heart in Yerushalayim. And this is written in Shulchan Aruch. If you don't know the direction, just direct your heart to Yerushalayim. So I thought, okay, this I can't do. I can't open the window. It was a very small window and the ceiling with a lot of grates on it. But I would stay at the wall and look again the window, like we say, Mi'amamakim karaticha Hashem, mamesh. And you know, Ana Hashem, Moshiana. And I would say in my prayer, Ribon Shalom, take away my Am Yisrael from Soviet prison. And take care of my father, he's ill. And then I would end and tell, and don't forget me, I can't withstand any more here. So praying this way, each moment I have free time between the interrogations, one day the door of the cell opened and some guards entered my cell, and they thought, all the time you are standing at the wall and like touching it and looking in the window. What are you doing? Were you trying to escape, to take away a brick out from the wall? They checked all the wall, it was intact. So what's the reason? Then they looked in my pockets and they found the tefillah. I told, okay, it is a letter. It was in Lashon Kodesh. It's a letter. You try to pass through the window a letter to your friends. You know, it was really crazy to think about that. But there was no way to know that. Anyway, they took away my tefillah to translate it. And then later escorted back to the office of this my Russian big brother. I saw my letter on his table, and he told me very angrily, Yosef, you became religious, you know. You never been religious. Who influenced you? Like, you know, you see a young man seated in solitary confinement, and there are transformations going on. There's somebody is influencing. So obviously it was Ribon Shel Olam, but he would never believe, you know. So I told him, I told you always that I'm Jewish, and every Jew is praying. It's normal practice, or every Jew cover to head and whatever, which I would know that is not the truth. But you know, when you make a statement, it has to be 100%. All Jews are covering the head, all Jews are praying, and it is me. Okay, he told me, take him down, let him think again. Maybe he will still make it sure. When I was in the cell, I was so glad, you know, that I found the right way, that I built this wall between me and him, and he would never mention that I am not Jewish. So the last stroke, what to do else? Shabbos, I told, I can't keep Shabbos. Often in Israel, you know, there are no possibility almost of keeping Shabbos. Anyway, I decided that I will clean the walls. It was very dirty. So I asked for a piece of cloth and the water and start rubbing the wall. And all of a sudden, among the bricks, I felt something sharp. What was? It was a small piece of a nail. Okay, I thought, I can scratch with this nail two candles. And I can, like, making me lighting the candles. Little mentioning. And also my mother would never lighten candles. She was a communist believer, you know, would never do that. We had in our clandestine a postcard from Israel showing a woman lighting candles, making like that, and there was a brocha down in the postcard. So I decided I will do the same. So I wrote my prayer for Kabbalah Shabbos, and then I prepared some more bread. I would collect bread for Shabbos during the whole week, you know. As we say, Yosef Shomer Shabbat. So this piece of bread will be for Shabbos. So I had a big pile of dried bread at Shabbos. I tore my handkerchief, made a cover for Shabbos from the handkerchief, and another one to another the second part for cover to cover my head. And then I made this scratch these candles, and I made the broche. I shake each other and so stuff. And then, you know, when I removed my hands, I saw really flames in the candle. Unbelievable. Believe me, it's a real miracle. There was flames going on in the candle. I got so excited, I started dancing in the jail and singing the songs we studied in the cemetery. Am Israel Chai! Am Israel Chai! David Melech Israel! And then a guard knocked at my door. You crazy man, he told me. Stop noising, you know, you disturb your friends, other cellmen. I told me, you know, it's a big Jewish holiday, it is a Shabbos today. Yeah, we know you are a religious fanatic, but stop noising and disturbing other people. And I imagined myself, you know, they would watch everybody coming to each door, and they have small eyes to look at each prisoner. So what they would see? Everybody broken there without any expectation, and then coming to my cell all of a sudden, light inside, and then it's dancing and enjoying. And I believe they would say, see how strong the nation is and how important is Shabbos, that even in the prison he can rejoice having Shabbos. It was my another victory. And then finally, the time of the trial came, we were escorted to the court, but we are not permitted to meet each other. Simply guarded from both sides by two guards, that we couldn't even look at the direction of our friends, not to support them, not to try to, you know, influence them. But still, after several days, a friend of mine sitting close to me somehow managed to whisper me and to say, Yosef, you know, today is the first candle of Hanukkah, Nerishon Shel Hanukkah, as we say in Yiddish, is geworden mir lichtig in de Egen. You know, I understood that the Ribono Shel Olam positioned this trial on Hanukkah for its the time of Nisim, Yeshuot Milchamot, and I felt all of a sudden myself so strong. You know, I thought, now I have drafted to be a part of Hasmonaim army, and I also we are in a prison, we are broken, we have to be strong. And I believe this special atmosphere of Hanukkah influenced a lot of all my friends. For as I told you, their goal was to stage a big performance of us admitting guilty and ask to pardon them and admitting that it was wrong to be Jewish, whatever. So the trial started, and they asked Mr. Dimshitz, the head, for certainly he had to have this heavy penalty of death, and he has his wife in the prison and his two daughters arrested. So the judge will ask him, Mr. Dimshitz, you were a major in the Russian army, and you were a member of Communist Party. How you come at all to the idea to betray your communist motherland? So I assumed that according their plan, they had to admit and ask for pardon and favor. All of a sudden, you know, he come up and then told, I accuse you Russians of being anti-Semitic. You take away all our Jewish education. You close our all yeshivas and schools. And you try to assimilate our nation. It is why I try to take people away and to open the Iron Gate. I accuse him in it. It was altogether unexpected. You know, the judge was astonished. I believe that they prepared him for another role, but it was a specific atmosphere of Hanukkah that make him all of a sudden come up and make this kind of statement. And then they reckoned there was a woman, Silva Zalmonson, that, you know, she was really broken in the prison, for her husband was the second one to get death penalty, and she would cry all the time in the prison. We felt that she is altogether broken. So they asked Silva, what's the reason you try to betray your Soviet motherland? And Silva came up and told in Russian Kurdish, we swear from our beginning, Im eshkachech Yerushalayim, tishkach imini. The judge asked for translation. She translated him. You know, he was astonished, you know, I almost couldn't believe that it happens. You know, all the game was broken. And then people would come up and make this kind of strong declarations as well. And I say it was like each of us lighting a candle of his body. For it was dangerous. It was obvious that making this statement we will get heavy penalties. But people were not afraid. And then my time came and asked Mendelevich, they did know that they couldn't expect anything about me, but still they asked, you know, that to ask what's the reason you betrayed your Russian Muslims, whatever. I thought, see, Ribono Shel Olam gave Eretz Yisrael to Avraham, Yitzchak and Yaakov, and I am their grandchild, so it's my place to be there. So one of the prosecutors jumped up and told, and when you ask the man, you know, don't you know he is a religious fanatic? You know, we can't understand how this man studied in the university and still he is not interested in anything except of Torah and mitzvahs and Eretz Yisrael. So, you know, I felt myself privileged. I told, I won the battle. Only several months before, the interrogator would say, you know, you are Russian guy, stop being Jewish, whatever. For he felt the time there, his slave, you know, being in a cell, in his hands, he can break me. And all of a sudden, it turned out that I am not a slave, that I am Ben Horin. For Ben Horin is doing something that he would like to do and to enjoy. And I enjoy being Jewish, you know, it's the best joy in my life, to being Jewish. So I'm a free man. So, indeed, they passed the verdict of death penalty for Mr. Dimshitz, and there is another man living in Mozart, half Jewish, Eduard Kuznetsov. He was already twice in a prison, and it's called Muad, as we say in Baba Mitzia, Muad Lipuranud. So he got the second death penalty, and I was the third one to get 15 years of imprisonment of trying to escape from Soviet Russia, 15 years of imprisonment trying to harm state security, and 15 years trying to betray my Russian motherland, and then 7 years for my Jewish activities. You know, it sounds maybe terrible, but it was life. And we felt bitter that for them it is death. So, it was still Hanukkah time. Like now, in a couple of days, an officer of KGB entered my cell at night, mamish, like 11 o'clock, and told me, brought a piece of paper and told, write a cassation, like an appeal to change the verdict. I told, how, you know, I need a lawyer to consult, it's very, very complex. He told me, we don't have time, write yourself. So I would write on a small piece of paper that he would produce. I told, you know, you charged me for betraying my motherland. I never betrayed my motherland. My motherland is not Russia, it's Israel. I never betrayed it. And then I thought I have not anything against Soviet Union, you know. I just don't belong. It's not my place. And I asked several times formally for permission to leave, and you refused. So I had no way out. So I think that your verdict is wrong, and you have to change it. He laughed at it, and he told, "It's the kind you try and appeal. You know, you have to change it." I said, "I can't change it." So, okay, you know, I was not aware that this night they collected all these appeals from all my friends and flew it directly from Leningrad to Moscow. For in the morning they had a session of the High Court, and how I find out what's happening, this friend of mine, Mr. Ari Hanok, knocked at the wall, and that time I did already know that the prisoner would communicate through the walls, you know. We had a mic, so he would talk in this, and I would listen, and also the walls was like a half a meter and a half thick. You can listen very clearly. See, so he would tell me, "Yosef, I met my brother now, and he told me that all the death penalties being cancelled under the heavy pressure of war jury, and you got your penalty softened as well. You got only 12 years of imprisonment, and I got 10, and still I got 8. And then I understood what happened, and in fact, what people, when I was out, told me. It was really another miracle of Hanukkah. Imagine people lighting the candles and telling, "Alanisim, Balchot, Mechamosh, Asitan, Avotenu, Biamim, Ahem, Bismanazeh," in our times. So people, after lighting the candle and listening to world news, to find out the Jews are being put to death for trying to be Jewish, you know. It was an interpretation in Zman Hazeh, at our times. So people felt that they cannot simply stay in their apartments. They start walking out, protesting, and it's how Mr. Brezhnev, that time the leader of the Communist Party, got telephones and cables from Nixon, from other presidents, France, or whatever. Stop! Don't harm the Jews, you know, give freedom to the Jews. It was a real big, big miracle of Hanukkah. So, when after getting the final charge, I was moved to the prison in Siberia to serve my 12 years, on the way, for people that are removed in trains. There are some millions of prisoners, so you can't simply move them in buses. You know, we were being removed in big trains. I got a couple of letters that were written when I was under interrogation, and later this trial, people would say in the letters, "Yosef, we got permission to leave." And then another letter saying, "We are on the way to Israel. Thanks, friend, it is because of you." And then for my two sisters, "We got permission to leave." So I understood it was really victory for that time, immediately after our arrest, and thanks of the whole process that the whole world jury started working for us. The Soviet Union decided to give up, and the emigration started. That year, some 13,000 got permission to leave. Next year, some 30,000, 35,000, and it went on and went on. So when I was in the prison, I told to myself, knowing that, I thought, okay, if my being in the prison brings freedom for other people, I'm ready to be there in the prison, you know, as much as needed. And I assume that Rabbanu Shalom again heard my feeling, and I spent 11 years in a Russian prison. And it was a very complex experience, for I had to behave Jewish. I have to keep Sabbath. And it was illegal there. So if I have some 10 minutes, I will describe you how it was about. Okay? When in prison, for the beginning, I was met with a Jewish guy, nowadays, Rav Shimon Gradius, that told me, Yosef, you know, I dreamt to meet a Jew instructed in Judaism, you know. When I heard that a group of Jews were arrested on the airplane, at the airport, I figured maybe there are somebody that can teach me. For when I was arrested, he was arrested because of his democratic activities to try to improve the Soviet system. And then when he told me I was arrested with my friend, Jewish, we decided to stop all these activities and became believer Jews. But we don't know anything about that. So, can you teach me? I told Shimon, okay, it was night time. So I told him, let us sleep and in the morning I will tell you everything. He told me, what he told me, you know, I hate for 2 years, I hate myself being like a goy, and you tell me to wait another night? No, I demand, teach me on the spot. So as far as my knowledge was almost as this story with Hillel, that I can tell it shortly, standing on one foot. So I told him, you know, Shimon, we have to keep Sabbath, we have to keep kashrus, we have to get a sigur and a chumash, and we have Jewish. He told me, you know, you are not realistic. You understand, it is a prison of very heavy regime for specifically dangerous prisoners. You can't get a sidur, it's all, everything forbidden, not Sabbath and not food, you know. They are cooking the food in a general kitchen for everybody. So what else he told me, you know, I can cut my pants and get a piece of clothes if you can sew two kippahs for me and for yourself. So he cut his pants and I produced a kippah for myself or for him, now not from a handkerchief, a real one kippahs for my father, Lord Shalom, was a Schneider, so I didn't know how to do that. So we start keeping mitzvahs, and later on Shimon told me, you know, we can eat grass, you know, the plants growing in the yard of the prison, but some of them are eatable, you know. And it is how we start eating whatever, like, you know, there are vitamins still. Also, if I say we add grass, you would say miskinim, but in fact we add vitamins. And then he told me, I met one Georgian prisoner, and he told me that he has a Georgian herb, a special Georgian herb that has a lot of protein, so we can cultivate it and eat it. So one day I had a small garden with this Georgian herb. I took care of it in the corner of the barrack. All of a sudden I heard an order saying to me, "You prisoner, what you doing there? Come up." So I understood they found out my garden and they would distract it. For they would like us to die, not to eat vitamins. So I come to the officer, and I saw that it's a special delegation from Moscow, very high-ranked officers, not our local ones of the prison. And the man told me, "What do you have on your head?" I told him, "It's a yarmulke. Every Jew is covering his head, you know, the altemeise." So he told me, you know, "Oh, I understand you are religious. You are permitted to be religious, but in your heart. Nobody has to show to see it outside. It's like a religious propaganda when you have it on your head." And then he told me, "See, I have a list of belongings that are permitted to keep for a prisoner, and there is no kippah written in it. So I say remove the kippah, or otherwise I will punish you for breaking the rules of the prison, and you never declare that you were persecuted like a religious Jews. It is simply for, living up the rules of the prison." So I refused, and the soldiers took me aside, benched me, saw me on the earth, and then grabbed my kippah and told, "Next time we shall punish you. Beware." Okay, the same they did to Shimon, but we have some more pants, so I produced some more kippahs. So they start chasing us, putting in a punishment rooms, on limiting our foods. But for us it was nothing, you know. We felt that the moment we thought that it is important for a Jew, you can't give it up. Finally, Shimon was released from the prison, for he had to serve only when I met him some 3 years more, and I remained myself. According to their rules, I was permitted, every prisoner was permitted to have a private meeting with his parents. So my father came to see me, and when entering the room to see my father, the guard stopped me and told, "You know, you are breaking the rules of the prison. You are having the keep on your head. Remove it, or otherwise we shall cancel your meeting." You know, I told, "I can't remove the. It's forbidden to remove the keeper." "Okay, so your meeting is cancelled." And I even couldn't explain to my father what's the reason. For if I would write, they would black it out. So next year, my father come again. And there's some story, you know. They say, "Remove your keeper, otherwise we shall punish you." I felt very bad about that, you know. My father was ill and old. I wouldn't believe that I can see him again. But then, you know, as we say in Gemara, Asro Hanal, even the slice in your boots, if the goyim believe that it's important, you are not permitted to give up. So I thought, in no way, never I will remove my kippah. Okay, you are meeting his cancelled. So it went on for several years until my father indeed passed away, and I never saw him. But I think there was no way to do it different. And then it was a simple, a simple thinking. For I understood that it goes like that. If you give up one step, they understand that you are weak. They will crush up on you and crush you all together. So it's like you, if you stay on this position, like when a dog is running on you, if you escape, he will jump on you. If you stood fast, he understands you are strong, no possibility to influence you. So later on, before Shimon was released, he told me, "You know, I found a man in the enterprise, a prisoner himself, that admitted that he is ready to write like we are working on Sabbath, to inform the authority of the prison that we are going to the enterprise and work on the Sabbath, and then we can produce necessary production during the week, so we will give it not on Sabbath, before Sabbath, and he will declare that it's being produced on Sabbath." So even when he was released, I continued going to the enterprise and staying in a certain place, praying, and watching the guards. If they would enter, I would escape to the general place, just making me to going around, like, say, midaytzach, you know. You're going around like you are going to work, nothing happens. And then there was another miracle that my friends managed to corrupt a certain Russian guard, giving him money, to bribing him, and he smuggled in the prison a siddur, you know. And it was unbelievable, you know. I was so glad. But when I look at this siddur, it was printed in Israel. It was obvious. And all around, all other prisoners were Sanei Israel. They would inform immediately that I am having a strange book and it will be confiscated. So I decided that I will stay in a factory at night. They would work in shifts, three shifts. So at night almost nobody would go to work in the factory. Went back in the morning from the factory, the barrack was empty, and I could easily pray, you know, nobody would disturb me. And then I decided that I would copy my prayer, my siddur, in small pieces of paper that big as a matchbox, and put it in this matchbox. So if the siddur would be confiscated, I would have another siddur, a secret one. So I would sit a man between the boards. You imagine a big barrack with some 100 boards inside, and me between the boards, trying to copy the cedar and watching the guards entering the barracks so I could put it under the mattress. And when I finished my job, all of a sudden I understood that I remember it by memory. You know, this effort brought all the feelings on my memory. I could pray myself. Then I really felt that I am a Ben Horin, that guy, you know, I am independent. Even being in a punishment room, I can pray myself. So, and I use the same techniques when keeping Sabbath. Being in the enterprise, I had a special matchbox with a prayer on Sabbath that was different and I couldn't remember. So I would stand in a small window, watch as I told the guards entering to escape. After several years doing it successfully, all of a sudden, one day, I heard steps in my back. So I understood the guards entered from a different gate, that I couldn't watch them. I was ready to escape, but I didn't know it. As we say, Oti Beinil Bein Chai, it's not a political manifestation to say I keep Sabbath. It's secret, it's between me and Ribono Shel Olam. So I was already to cheat them and escape to the enterprise, but I saw that the second of the prison, Mr. Major Fyodorov, come to see me. So I understood that they know everything, that I am keeping Sabbath. And I decided to keep fast. He looked at me very quietly, enjoying the moment, you know, and told me, Mendelevich, why are you not working, you know? You have to deserve your food, you know. Nobody is giving you food without you working. Go to work, deserve your food. I told him, Major Fyodor, don't you know that I am Jewish? Jews don't work on Sabbath. I will not go to work. He told me, what? Now, you know, he became very angry and started shouting and telling me, you think you are in a rest house. You are in a prison. I will put you under the earth. You will die here if you don't go to work. Go to work immediately. So I was very quiet. And I, you know, indeed, friends passed over telling me that if there is pikuach nefesh, I am permitted to work on Sabbath. But I felt that there is no the case of pikuach nefesh. I am young and I am strong, and he couldn't put me under the earth, under the ground. What else? He can put me in a punishment room. But I was many times in a punishment room. I am not afraid, you know, being there, having a piece of bread and a glass of water and sleeping on the floor. That's all their punishment. I can withstand that. So I answered him quietly, Major Fyodorov, I'm not afraid of you. I have my lord, you know, I take his orders. Okay, he told me, take him to the special prison for people that break rules in this labor camp. And when escorted by the guards, you know, two Russian big guys, I looked to one of them, and second I said, Mimini Mikhail, Umi Smoli Gavri. I thought, Russians, I thought, Ribono Shel Olam, I thank you for the privilege, you know, to be Mesiras Nefesh for Sabbath, you know. I thought, imagine maybe there is no other Jew in the whole universe like me that being punished for keeping Sabbath, you know. I felt very excited. So when put in this punishment room and cold, you know, there is winter all over the year. After, you know, several days, Sabbath, Shabbat, they opened the door. Mendelevich, go to the work. I told, no, I am not working. Again, go to the work. No, I am not working. So for a month they kept me and tried to break me. I would, you know, as they say, nothing special in it, you know. I would have some pieces of bread, some water. That's much enough, you know. Not enough to break my emune. So finally they brought me to a court and charged me with breaking the rules of the prison and being parasite, not working, and influencing badly on other fellows for I make out of them to mitzvahs. So, and they charged me with 3 years of imprisonment in closed prison on very harsh conditions. So they sent there me to again in a train, and on the train I had the time to figure out how, you know, to get inside this prison some Jewish belongings. For as a matter of fact, a friend, my student, Shimon Grilus, when in Israel, I asked him to send me a talis cotton, and he sent me over in a parcel a talis cotton. When the guards got it, they called me and they told me, we got something that we cannot understand, what is that? And they showed me the talis cotton. How to explain? I told, you know, it's a Jewish way of having an undershirt. Like the Scott people have this skirt. Now we have our Jewish undershirts with the stitches. Okay, you told me, we know it. You know, it's a religious article. You're not permitted to have it. It's confiscated. But for some reason, you know, when I on the way, they give me this talis cotton in the train. I understood that when reaching the second harsh prison, they had already documents telling that it should be confiscated. So, what to do? I pulled out the tzitzis, and I had a pair of white woolen socks, who I put the tzitzis, like, you know, there's a, for children, there are stocks with a pomponim, as we say, you know, like, so. And then I figured another thing, how to smuggle inside a chumash. For it was permitted to have five books printed in Russia, but the chumash was printed not in Russia. And then all of a sudden I come on an idea that I had a book in Yiddish, printed in Russian. It was a translation of the speeches of Mr. Brezhnev, their leader. You know, it was so stupid having this book. I couldn't understand why they permitted me to have. And then all of a sudden I understood, for this Yiddish book was the same growth, same format of the Chumash. So I just pulled out the first page of the Yiddish book that was written in Yiddish in Russian language that is being printed in Moscow. I chewed bread, make like a glue, and I glue it down this page to my chumash. So when you open it, it's written, published in Moscow, permitted by the authorities. I say I was the first that published chumash, a legal chumash in Soviet Russia. So when I entered the prison, they simply checked my belongings. You have five books permitted. Open the first page. Okay, you are permitted to have socks. No problem. You know. Get your socks. For in fact, the prison was for the heads of mafia, you know, for very heavy gangsters. So they looked for weapon, for money, for drugs, not for tzitzis and chumash. So I easily got in inside, and then I asked the guards when entering the cell, say what kind of occupation do they have in the prison, just to figure out how can I escape and not working on Sabbath. And the man told me, what occupation, you know? You are like a dangerous animal that we got in a cage, and we never opened the cage, you know. There is no occupation for you. Nothing to do. So I understood that I have 3 years of having no problem with Sabbath. They don't work on Sabbath. And I told this exactly what I learned in Pirkei Avos. I say mitzvah achat, zechel lasot mitzvot rabot. Mitzvah goreret mitzvah. So I made my mitzvah of keeping Sabbath, and I deserve instead, you know, a very quiet Shabbos, Talmud Torah, and mitzvah tzitzis. For I took out the tzitzis out from the socks, and I had a scarf. So I put in 4 angles of the scarf, and since then I keep mitzvah tzitzis as well. So finally, when being back to a regular prison after serving the 3 years, you know, I felt myself somehow exhausted. I served already 11 years. And I told, you know, I told Rivon Shalom, I don't know, as the Talmud says, Eretz Yisrael Niknet Beisurim. And I told, Eretz Yisrael is Aleph Yud, it is 11. And I served already 11 years. So maybe I already, you know, have in exchange of my 11 years, you can give me your Eretz Yisrael. And it was my last Hanukkah in the prison. And again, Ribono Shel Olam heard to my prayer, to my tefillah. Mamish, in a month, I was sent from the prison directly to Moscow, to their central KGB prison in Lefortovo. And I was afraid, for I thought that maybe they are preparing another case against me. For as they, you understand, I was not quiet there. I was, and they were angry with me. So anyway, after 2 weeks of expectations, I was escorted for the first interrogation. And when I entered the room, it was something strange. There were two major generals seated and somebody plain clothes. I understood they used in Stalin time have a troika, so-called, that they would, like a trial, they would, you know, execute you on the place. So what will happen? This plainclothes man took a piece of paper and he announced, according to the decision of Supreme Soviet, because of this bad behavior of this criminal Mendelevich, now the Soviet decides to cancel his Soviet citizenship. You don't deserve anymore to be our citizen, and to send him away to whatever place he would like to go. So I told Baruch Hashem, Baruch Shmo. He told me what you are saying. And so I bless Kadosh Baruch Adonai Asari B'Makom Hazeh. He told, okay, you know, we know that you are real traitor, you know. You are born, it's your motherland, and we are sending you away from your motherland, and you enjoy it. I told, no, it's wrong, you know, my motherland is Israel. I was born in Russia, but every Jew has only one motherland, that depends where he's born. Okay, he told, we know you Jews can't talk, you know. Just don't, we don't have any time. And it has happened with me, like in this parsha of the book, Miketz, that when they took Yosef out from the prison, you know, they make me a shower, a good shower, brought me a good clothing, Pierre Cardin, that I would use it many years later for service, put me in a big black car, escorted by one major general, and policemen on bicycles, escorting from two sides, and directly from the prison to the airport, you know. And Major General told me, you know, we are giving you a covet like you are a president. So I thought, you know, I am not a president. My grandfather was Michel Lemela, so I deserve some kind of, you know, this covet. Anyway, when brought to the airplane, coming up, I told to this general, I told, see, you arrested us 11 years ago in the airport to prevent us from going to Israel. But I was aware that at that time only 300,000 Jews left. And I told, see, you were mistaken. And I tell you, general, I told, you have to permit some, you know, Shishim Ribo, some other Jews to leave. You have to let all Jews go out, or otherwise your empire will crash down. I even intimidated them, still I was in his hands. And I assume he was a man from a new generation, like Putin or something. He wasn't serious, and he told me, you know, we could never believe that you Jews have this strong will of you. You know, normally they picture Jews as cowards, people that cannot resist. But I thought that's not true. You know, we don't have a strong will. We are regular people, you know. But I remember the saying, as I taught my students in underground Ulpan, Ein davar haomed bifnei haratzon. What kind of haratzon? It is haratzon. It's the will of the Kadosh Baruch Hu. It's the will of Kadosh Baruch Hu to bring his Am Yisrael back to Eretz Yisrael, back to the roots, back to being a good Jews. And even the Russian Empire cannot prevent it. End of all, Haomed Bifnei Haratzon. Thank you.